Even though the title of this podcast is Dialogues with Creators, I'm going solo this episode. I hope to share some wisdom and advice about creativity, writing, teaching, life, maybe some other things. If you've ever wondered what's going on in my head or not, stay tuned. Howdy, hola, good afternoon, bonjour, and hello, or maybe it's good morning. I'm recording this on Sunday, April 21st. These podcasts have been coming out every 2 weeks. So far this season, I have interviewed 8 folks. I want to review them. So first of all, you'll go back and listen to the episode and that you will also look them up. My goal in this endeavor is to get listeners to know about creative people who are out there and need your attention, if you will. Debbie and Danny Lance were the first in this season, and I call them spiritual or ministry entrepreneurs. They began the East Ridge Creative Arts Center on Ringgold Road in East Ridge. It's near the corner of Ringgold Road and Belvoir. This includes a coffee shop, and I've enjoyed a fine sandwich there and a cup of coffee. I encourage you to check them out because they are bringing arts and the church together in this really unique way. Then I spoke with Andrew Bullard, filmmaker of Access Control. You can check that out on streaming services, and it is really good, funny, and has a fine soundtrack. Kenyon Henry and Terry Bonds were my next guests. Both of them are involved with JC Films, and you can find them on the internet. And this is kind of an interesting setup that JC Films does. Kenyon wrote a film for them, and you may know Kenyon from his work with the Next Chapter Con, and he does that in the in October every year in Dalton and the surrounding area. And he helped the organization make the film in this area. And Terry was an actress in the film. And these films are also available on various streaming services. Dean Cain, who played Superman back in the 80s and 90s, I love that show, Lois and Clark, is highly involved with this venture. After that, we heard from Dr. Richard Herder, who is a part-time professor at Dalton State College in communication, and he is a scholar. And we talked about his book about how agricultural laborers organized to help their working conditions in Florida. Then Jerry Dry and Clint Kincaid, master storytellers, joined us for some insights into humor and story. That was fun. And finally, Emily Steele, filmmaker, conversed with me about her film Goodnight August, which she screened at Dalton State College. Upcoming, I hope to have a musician, a sculptor, a gallery owner, and some revisits. That's in the soon-to-come months. If you have any suggestions for creative people, just let me know. If you have any interest in sponsoring the podcast, let me know. There is some expense, and I don't really want to get advertising, and you have to have a lot of listeners before you can get advertisers anyway. And I don't have that many, not enough to have advertisers. So going to a twice-a-month format has taken some pressure off of me, but it has also slowed down the momentum we had going. However, it was necessary because of work pressures and mostly because of what's going on in the other part of my life, which is becoming a grandmother. Anna Inez was born on January 6th, and we've been in love ever since. She has changed so much in 3.5 months, and she has personality galore, and she tends to look like my side of the family or her father's side of the family, but she's also dark, has nice, beautiful brownish skin and beautiful eyes. And she's so smart. She speaks 2 languages already. She babbles in Spanglish. I'm not kidding here, because her mother mostly speaks Spanish to her, as do her mother's family. And I think I'm the one who speaks most of the English right now, although her mother speaks English to her as well. My Spanish is at a baby level anyway, but Spanish seems to calm her down when she's upset. And we are having a lot of fun. The great parts of being a grandparent, or in my case, a grandmother, are that you get to relive the joys of parenthood with more wisdom and somewhat less responsibility and stress. My son and daughter-in-law got to endure the endless sleepless nights, but Annie fell into longer periods of sleep at night fairly early, well before she was 2 months old. She has some nights where it doesn't work that way. Since I don't sleep straight through 8 hours anyway, I don't know how anyone does, especially a baby. You get to see this little person change and grow, and my word, when they smile at you, what is better? And Annie is a smiler, a laugher, a talker, a dancer, and an extrovert. She's a big flirt. The one thing she doesn't like is tummy time, which is a whole new thing for me. She's a little lazy about that. Babies used to stay on their stomachs much more, which allows them to learn to push up and develop muscles more easily. But it also leads to other things that we won't talk about here. Now, mothers are told to sleep, put them on their backs to sleep and to swaddle them. Annie didn't like swaddled. She loves to kick her feet. But tummy time is needed for the muscle development. She doesn't like it because it's a bit uncomfortable, and mostly she can't see the world as much as when she's facing outward or upward. The only downside is you don't get to get 100% time with the child. You have to share them more. On the other side, you can spend money on them the way you want. So I'm having a great time. Unfortunately, I had COVID that kind of got into my grandmotherhood there for a while. In early March, never fun. That always takes a while to get over. And life as a college professor and department chair has been busy. It is, however, my life as a novelist and content creator that I want to address here for a while. So if you want to hear more about writing and literature, here I go. And then I'll come to teaching at the end. I recently read a book called Save the Cat Writes a Novel. If you are not familiar with the Save the Cat books, I think every writer should at least get the concept, although I wouldn't say go buy the book. If you are someone who has read a great deal of fiction, either general literary fiction or in your genre, which would be fantasy or romance or westerns or spy or thrillers or mysteries or cozies, although I've never understood that expression, it's the cozy murder mystery. If you've read a lot of those kinds of books, you will understand the basic premise almost naturally. If you want to write a novel and have not read many of them, well, to be honest, you need to step back and learn story structure first, either by immersion or direct instruction. Now, my granddaughter Annie is learning Spanish by immersion. It's when her mother talks to her. I learned it by direct instruction, which is typical in schools. Spanish will be in her bones and natural. I have to think about my use of Spanish before I say anything. On the other hand, I learned novel structure less by direct instruction than by reading hundreds of them before I started to write them. Same with short stories. By structure, I mean what the reader experiences in reading the book. Sometimes it is very easy to forget that is the point. How will the reader go on this journey? What does the reader need to know and when? They don't need to know everything at the beginning, but they do need to know something. And they need to know that they want to keep reading. They need to know who, where, and when. Not why yet, and not even what. Well, maybe a little bit, but not all of it. But we start with a person, a character, in a place and time. And very soon that person needs to be confronted with some kind of challenge or circumstance. And then there's a logical sequence to what happens. The good and bad of the Save the Cat philosophy is that there's a very exact outline of actions / relationships / content to a novel in their thinking. It's pretty formulaic is the bad news. That it makes logical sense in the case of some type of novels is the good news. The term Save the Cat comes from the advice that the character has to do something good early on for the readers to like them, at least some. Enough to keep reading, even if they're not a good person. And in many cases, they won't be a good person because they have to go on this journey to become a better person, in a sense, to grow, develop in some way, to change. They have to do something that, like, save a cat from a tree. Now, that metaphor doesn't really work for me because cats are perfectly fine in trees. Where we ever got the idea they need to be saved from one is a mystery to me. All you just tie the dog up and they'll come down. Secondly, I don't see that action as worthy of me liking a character who might be a jerk otherwise. But, well, it might work for some people. I don't know. What the Save the Cat books do then is to show the sequence, the character, and any important co-characters have to go through in the story. As such, I thought the basic idea was helpful because it does focus on the reader experience more than the writer's motivations or pet themes or desire to write something that is like William Faulkner. It focuses on what makes a story, at least for modern film-oriented readers, work. The original Save the Cat book was about filmmaking, and really people do expect something film-like in structure when they read a novel. Now, whether they should or not is a different question, but I remember a young girl, daughter friend of mine, saying how boring and how hard it was to read Pride and Prejudice. She'd seen the movies and the miniseries, but Jane Austen is about dialogue and wit and manners and satire as much as a rom-com plot. In a rom-com, there is a meet-cute. Now, there is no meet-cute in Pride and Prejudice. Darcy insults Elizabeth's looks, and she happens to overhear it, which automatically gives her her prejudice against him, as well as the fact that he's a stuffed shirt. Then there, in a rom-com, there's a complication between these two lovers in what seems to be a budding relationship. The complication, it starts at the beginning in Pride and Prejudice, and the complications are all about her family, Mr. Collins, Lydia's a mess, you know, Wickham, all that. And then in a rom-com, after the complications, they get together. That happens in Pride and Prejudice, but she sees his real character because of what he does for her family, whom he has insulted, which is sort of like a rom-com, but there's a lot more about her own deep realization of her own flaws, which is not rom-com-y. In fact, one of the flaws Save the Cat writes a novel is that Jessica Brody tries to make some classics fit her formula, and all that shows is she doesn't understand them. Case in point is Jane Eyre. Now, I've read Jane Eyre at least three times, and I'm reading it again. And the reason I'm talking about the book here is that I read other writers' work, and sometimes the writing is led more by everything else than sticking to a coherent story that is going somewhere, where people do reasonably sequential and logical things. Not expected things, but not off the wall, not out of nowhere. There's the old Chekhov's gun analogy, and this is Chekhov, the Russian writer, not from Star Trek. He's if you mention a gun in the first act, the gun must have a point later. You don't just randomly bring stuff up that doesn't go anywhere. A fantasy world must follow its own rules, even if you made them up. And tangents to build character must contribute to the river of the story, not just sit there as pools. Maybe that's a metaphor I will use. Think of the Tennessee River. It has lots of creeks and tributaries, and they all lead somewhere. Now, you might think they lead to the Gulf of Mexico, but that's going to be my point here. If you have a little finger of the river that goes off into a wetland with no outlet, well, we know what happens there. It stagnates. Kind of nasty. All the elements must move toward its goal. Maybe that metaphor works, but no, it doesn't entirely. Yes, you might think the Tennessee River goes to the Gulf, and I've been told that because we have seagulls in Chattanooga, and they come up on the barges, but it doesn't get there naturally. You have to depend on an Army Corps of Engineers project called the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway. Tom Bigbee River is a river in Alabama. You can look this up. The Tennessee River runs from Knoxville to Chattanooga into Alabama and then back north to Paducah, of all things, to the Ohio River, which I guess it runs into the Mississippi. To get the Tennessee River water to the Gulf, nature had to be redesigned by building this Tennessee Tom Bigbee River Canal Waterway, and it's in Alabama. In the same way, a storyteller takes nature and natural flow of human activity, daily activity in some times, and redesigns it a bit, changes reality a bit to make it interesting. Now, I'm going to bring up a concept here that's going to seem a little weird. There's a principle in advertising and design called MAYA, M-A-Y-A. That stands for most advanced yet acceptable, or accessible would work too, I think. You can look this up. It's basically the idea that for an innovation to be useful, it has to improve what already is, but can't be too strange for people to accept it. And I think an example would be if Steve Jobs somehow had invented the iPhone in the late 80s, as opposed to the mid 2000s, it would have been too much. People would not have accepted it. There had to be some evolution to where they got used to the idea of actually having a cell phone before he could do what he did. The idea is that there's a sweet spot. Actually, when you try to sell a book to a publisher, you have to say it's like a famous novel, but different. And you're really saying better when you say that. But that's how we pitch a lot of things. Why? Because of MAYA, most advanced yet acceptable. There's a bridge between what is and what the audience or consumer will accept. Now, some artists are way ahead of their time, like a Van Gogh, but he also suffered immeasurably for that. And it was a hard life for him. So if you don't change reality a little, the story is just, I got up, I ate breakfast, I took a shower, I drove to work, blah, blah, blah. The storyteller engineers a story, a person getting to a place they would not naturally be by bringing elements, building the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway between the regular and the possible. Just like the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway was an act of creativity, that is where our creativity comes in. I'm reminded of the play Our Town. I love that play, and I get teased for that, but really, I only love it for one reason: the twist in the last act. The whole point of it is that these are super ordinary people. But the main character, a young wife, dies in childbirth in the last act. And that's where it changes. She and the other deceased people in the town, our town, are in the cemetery and they're having a conversation as dead people. And she wants to go back. She can't accept this new being, state of being of a dead person. And she wants to relive one day. And she says, and they let her, and she says, it'll be her 11th birthday. And it's heartbreaking because she realizes how wonderful every day of life is while you're living it, but no one there living that 11th birthday realize it. They're just humdrumming through it. As another example, let's take Jane Eyre, which I'm reading now again, as I said, if you don't know the novel, but have watched the movies of it, you really don't know the novel, but you get the general idea. Jane's life takes her to some unusual places, to say the least. There are some twists in the story, especially after she leaves Rochester, for good reason, in my opinion, where you could say that wasn't believable. What happens is she is discovered and saved and found by her cousins, and she ends up, she doesn't know they're her cousins, but they happen to be, and in the middle of nowhere. And she also ends up an heiress. So maybe it is unbelievable. Maybe it's not. Coincidences happen in real life, and I can tell you many for myself. But I would argue that she has, Charlotte Bronte has put the at least some of that in the early part of the novel, so that it's not totally unexpected. You wouldn't expect them, but you're not blown away by them. The storyteller builds the story so that the turns and twists are surprising, most advanced, yet acceptable, because the seeds of those elements have been planted earlier. However, we could get into a discussion. Should Jane even love Rochester? Well, she loves him before she finds out about Bertha, the mad woman, the first wife. And you could ask, is Bertha really mad, or did she was just made that way by being locked up by the monster Rochester? And Jane loves Rochester through his offering her to be his mistress after the wedding doesn't go through, and she would have no legal protection, and it would be against her value system. And she loves him when she no longer needs him financially, because she inherits plenty of money, and he's in a different stage of life. She found such a connection with him before all the obstacles that she still loved him. I'd have said enough is enough after the wedding gets called off, but that is the point. Jane Eyre's character is of such great virtue and integrity despite her trials, and she has this need, and you have to have a character who needs something, who wants something greatly. She needs to be loved since she's been so mistreated. But she won't have him as his mistress. It's the real commitment or nothing. Would a modern woman accept her situation? Well, some do. We judge them for it, I suppose. But we don't judge Jane. We root for her because she keeps her values within her framework. We feel such empathy for her because of her mistreatment, and yet how faithful and she has been throughout this. And that is the end point of this discussion. We have to feel a connection and empathy for the characters. And so now for the commercial, well, the promo. During COVID, I did a lot of writing, but writing is not the same as producing something you want other people to read. That's probably a topic for another podcast, but writing is essentially communicating and is about connection with the reader. So a writer has to think of audience first. I don't mean about making money. I mean creating a reading experience for others, serving your readers that way, if you will. I read a lot of novels in critique groups, and some of them have great promise. And this is not an overall blanket endorsement or criticism. But this was several years ago, so nobody who is listening to this would know who it is. I read a novel for a critique group where the first 5 pages were a woman sitting in her bathtub contemplating bubbles and just thinking. Nobody else was there. We didn't know this person. We just knew she was like how the bubbles looked on her legs, and she was thinking about stuff. 50 pages on, something inciting still hadn't happened. And we'd been introduced to some people, but we didn't know what the main character wanted or what the main conflict was. I learned a long time ago, start with the snake. Start in the middle of the action, like Homer did, and use backstory in media res, but make people want to read. Anyway, after COVID, I finally put those COVID drafts into more readable and publishable formats. In March, I self-published Long Lost Justice, the third and definitely best of my Long Lost series. I believe it's excellent and the second best thing I've written. The best novel I have written is coming out in May. It's being published by Colorful Crow Publishing of Calhoun, and which is owned by Carly Land. And I want you to look into them. And to return to the idea of making characters with whom the audience can empathize, I believe I've done that. In fact, one of my beta readers says I created an iconic character that will be very hard to forget. I really appreciate that. It is a very different book from Long Lost Justice, or really anything else I've written. Long Lost Justice starts with a violent hate crime that is never solved or even investigated for decades. Lying In, which is the book I'm publishing next, it will be published in hardcover at first, as well as Kindle, is set in Appalachian Virginia. Now, or you might say Appalachian Virginia, but we'll not argue over that. During the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918. And the beginning starts less dramatically than a violent hate crime, but more like a dawning of a day, a trip through changing scenery, a song that leads more to more intensity. I don't want to give too much away, but I promise you an historically valid story, characters you can remember, and a plot that doesn't plod, but that builds toward what Save the Cat calls the all is lost moment. And the main character meets that moment head on, not giving up. And that's, I'm very proud of that moment because she just says no to how she's been treated, like Jane does in Jane Eyre. Lying In refers to the period of time women would recuperate from births and gain their strength. The main character, Telly, takes care of women who have given birth, wandering from home to home for short periods of time to do this. She wants her own home. She wants the stability of love and family. However, she has a disfiguring disease that also makes her a social outcast, even though her work is valued such as it is. So we have a character with backstory thrown in an epidemic and worse, and she has to move her way through it with grit and faith. I think you'll enjoy it. The seven who have read it have enjoyed it. I will be having book launches and I plan to obnoxiously publicize this one. I think I finally got it right after 10 of them. Finally, I want to talk about teaching. This little thing I've been thinking. Teaching well is the biggest creative enterprise in the world. And I've been teaching for almost 5 decades and see how much more there is to learn about it and how to do it well. I look back and I tend to see everything I did wrong. And we know a whole lot more about the brain now and how it works, especially in learning. It's a fascinating study. And there's so many great books out there about it. And we know that the brain doesn't work if the body is not hydrated, rested, and fed correctly. Even how much water you take. Now, my doctor told me I had to drink a whole lot more water, and it's a struggle, but you got to do it, and you do start to feel much better. Excuse me. We have a lot of inspirational quotes about teaching, and I'm going to be a cynic, and I think we have these inspirational quotes to make up for the low pay. Teaching is not X, but Y. Okay, and you've probably heard these things. Teaching is not filling a mind, but something, something else. Inspiring curiosity, lighting a fire. It's 3 parts this and 1 part that. Teaching is not a job, but a way of life. I found that one today on the internet. That's the problem is that it seems like 24/7, especially if you teach online. Teaching is not a service, profession, or job. Well, yeah, it is. But anyway, it is a pillar of the society. Okay, these are all great, but what teaching is hard work and emotionally draining as well as emotionally fulfilling. It is especially more emotionally draining now, and I've been doing it since 1978, with the mental health crisis we are seeing, although some of that may be some social contagion. It's hard to talk about that subject without seeming cynical and harsh on one side. Something like a curmudgeon who says, why can't they be like we were, perfect in every way? And you see why I don't sing publicly, which is a line from a song in By My Birdie. And so it's hard to talk about the subject of being this old crank, or on the other side, being too willing to accept the idea of our young people today as fragile, weak, incapable beings with no resilience, no brains, no ability to figure it out for themselves. And so I find myself in this conundrum here. Recently, a book has come out by Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, and I have not read it yet. I will. It's pricey. I'm going to see if a library has it. And but he's saying what most of us already know, that the phones, the social media, and the continual access and connectivity to the internet and such has done this, has created just a mess. And he interestingly, and I talked about this with my life group today at church, I said he himself is not a person of faith, but he says the only thing that's going to change this is collective action. You know, where parents say we're going to change this, and he said the most logical place for this to start is in the church and in faith communities. And yeah, I mean, why do we have phones in church? Seriously, you know, they're there to distract. They distract me, and I'm an old person. So I think he makes a very good point for someone who's, you know, an expert social psychologist, but not really in our tribe, if you will, or tribe of Christian people. So anyway, I'm just very mindful of that. And Jean Twenge in iGen, she was really doing the same thing, but just 7 years ago. But the teaching takes a lot of creativity, even more now with the AI generation at everyone's fingertips. And this is usually used to create an obviously not student written essay or paper. And it takes a lot of creativity with the mental health needs. I can't get into specifics, but I have dealt directly or indirectly with at least 5 big mental health problems in the last couple of months. And like a lot of professors, I and my colleagues, we have empathy. We want to help. We know the students can't learn when their bandwidth, if you will, is so narrowed by these issues. And these issues sometimes are very serious: trauma, illness, pressures that we just can't imagine. Unfortunately, we also have 2 other things along with our empathy and desire to help. We have a lack of training to deal with them. And I don't even know how you would, I mean, without spending some really intense time with faculty to say, this is what you should do, other than call public safety. And I hate to say this, but we also have a basic fear of saying and doing the wrong thing and it unintentionally blown up in our faces. And to the extent that we might lose our own jobs or, you know, out of not knowing any better, or be litigated against. Hence, more pressure. A professor in an R1 may only have the pressure of publication or dealing with his or her colleagues, whom I hear can be quite jerky. A professor in an access college has a pressure of not knowing what the mental health possibilities in her or his classroom are. I'm just saying, I hope that in the time I have left in life, I can help people who want to be in the classroom with young people in higher ed, be better instructors, even if I step away from the classroom myself. And that is something that I hope to achieve as I look towards retirement. Thank you for listening. Please go back and listen to the others this season and in previous seasons. I don't say that because I'm going to make any money of it. I say it because I have talked with some really neat, fascinating people. Bye-bye.